stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeely reporting. Somali police say that they have ended an Islamist militant siege of a hotel in the capital, with at least 23 killed in a car bomb attack that left dozens more wounded. The Al-Shabaab militant group has claimed responsibility. There was a second car bomb blast Saturday near the former parliament building. The extent of the damage from that explosion was not immediately clear. Catalonia's deposed President Carles Puigdemont has vowed to keep fighting for independence after the Spanish central government ordered him to accept his cabinet's dismissal. The Spanish region of Catalonia is now under the direct control of Madrid. Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy dissolved Catalonia's parliament just hours after the regional body voted in favor of independence from Spain.
It is not a question of suspending self-government or of intervening or cutting it. It is simply a matter of returning self-government to normality as soon as possible. Normality begins by recovering institutional legitimacy and by returning the voice to the Catalans.
Rajoy also called for calm. A U.S. federal grand jury has approved the first charges in an investigation of Russian interference on last year's U.S. election. An investigation is looking into allegations the Trump campaign may have colluded with Russia to win the election. They also are examining the possibility Mr. Trump might have tried to interfere with the Russia investigation. The probe also is looking into possible financial ties between Russian businesses and members of the Trump campaign. This is VOA News. The Iraqi Kurdish parliament meeting today to redistribute powers away from President Masoud Barzani, who was under pressure to step down following an independence referendum last month. Iraqi Prime Minister Hadar al-Abadi called the referendum vote illegal and in response sent his forces to retake control of disputed areas that were in control of the Kurds. Barzani finds himself in a tough position after Iraqi federal forces moved to reclaim territory near the city of Kirkuk. A pre-dawn Taliban attack in northern Afghanistan has killed at least 13 government forces. The attack came a day after Afghan officials confirmed separate insurgent attacks in eastern Ghazni province. That killed at least 9 police personnel. Australian lawmakers in the state of Victoria are debating a bill to allow medically assisted dying, a highly controversial issue, fraught with arguments over who, if anyone, should be able to decide the time of their own death. In the Australian state of Victoria, the lower house of parliament passed legislation October 20th that would allow what the bill calls voluntary assisted dying. That vote came after a contentious marathon debate session lasting more than 24 hours. Once the bill passed, Victoria Premier Daniel Andrews told reporters he was very proud of that vote. 5 nations have legalized assisted dying. That's Belgium, Canada, Colombia, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. Assisted death usually means that being issued a prescription for drugs that will end the patient's life at the time and place of their own choosing. Most patients eligible for it are terminally ill and death is approaching soon, but patients in other circumstances have argued that they too should be able to choose assisted dying. Kenyan police used tear gas to disperse election protesters in Nairobi a day after a fire burned hundreds of businesses and men armed with machetes and sticks looted stores and homes. The Election Commission chief says that he will give an update on what he called the way forward in some opposition areas where voting in last Thursday's presidential election had not occurred because of security problems. Opposition leader Raila Odinga told his supporters to boycott that vote. President Uhuru Kenyatta is making his second attempt at re-election. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has been disqualified from Parliament because he was a dual national at the time of the last election. A court has ruled that 4 other politicians were also wrongly elected because they held British, New Zealand, and Canadian citizenship. Australia's constitution bans subjects or citizens of foreign powers from sitting in federal parliament. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
I think the manner this matter has been dealt with is not appropriate. Secondly, I think that Burundi doesn't deserve a president for life.
The Burundian government approves a constitutional amendment to enable President Pierre Nkurunziza to seek another term.
In the current circumstances, Uhuru Kenyatta was competing only Uhuru Kenyatta. So why are they trying to justify more votes?
The chairman of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission urges citizens to disregard election results circulating on social media platforms.
We just completed voter registration process. The next phase is distribution of voter ID to registered voters. We intend doing that next month, that is November.
And the Sierra Leonean National Electoral Commission will soon begin distributing voter identification cards. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The cabinet of Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has approved a constitutional amendment that will allow the president to stay in office until 2034. Under existing laws, Burundian presidents are limited to 2 5-year terms, but the amendment seeks to abolish the two-term limit and lengthen presidential terms to 7 years each, and also allow the president to seek re-election. Civil society and opposition groups have condemned the measure after accusing President Nkurunziza of wanting to become a life president. For more reaction, I reach Agathon Rwasa, Deputy Speaker of Parliament and leader of the main opposition National Liberation Forces, or FNL.
First of all, I think the cabinet was forced to approve that because even the draft was not distributed to the cabinet. So I think the manner this matter has been dealt with is not appropriate. Secondly, I think that Burundi doesn't deserve a president for life. And I suggest that President Nkurunziza would first evaluate his 12 years in office. I think Burundi has been seeing just its economy degrading and even collapsing. I think there is no room for political rights, because only the CNDD-FDD party can do its business freely, or anybody else who would like to do politics has to pay allegiance to CNDD-FDD. So I don't think that that's what Burundi deserves. And I hope that it's not yet far, as the constitution, it was just the report from the commission that was dealt with in the cabinet. Perhaps that they can think twice before going any further.
There are reports that the government seeks to organize a referendum on the draft legislation next year. That means that they are going to pass it through parliament. The constitution will be amended. How are Burundians reacting to this, and what is your party's reaction to this?
You know, many people didn't know what is going on after all, because nobody has seen that draft. So if they are hiding that draft, it means that they don't want anybody to contribute, which means that only Nkurunziza is concerned with that. He just wants him to be in office for life. He just wants to see Burundi knelt down before him, what is not acceptable at all.
The draft that is being speculated is that it will change the regular 5-year term to 7 years. In this case, it will allow the president to stay in power till 2034. What do you say to that?
What I would say is that somehow there is lack of seriousness in this matter. How come that President Nkurunziza himself, last year, in 2 years ago, in August the 20th, he would say that it was his last term. And now he's trying to make believe that the population is just claiming for him to stay in office. Isn't that a kind of the double standard policy of his? He wants to be in office for life, and he wants to load it on the shoulders of the citizens that they are the ones who want him in office for life. But come and see how the economy is today. Come and see how the human rights are. Come and see how everything is going on. I don't think that if Burundians were free to say what they like and what they want, I don't think that they would preach for Nkurunziza to stay in office for life.
But here is the case where neighboring countries have done the same. Rwanda has done it. You have Uganda doing it. There are even speculations that neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo could follow similar path. What is going to be different in Burundi, since in some of these places, the leaders say that there is an overwhelming support from the population for them to seek additional terms because they see them as doing pretty well for the country? Isn't it the same in Burundi, and what will be different?
The explanation will be so from the mouth of these leaders, but the reality is quite irrelevant with what they say. How come, for instance, here in Burundi, where people, when the President Nkurunziza has to move from a place to another, when the people are even forbidden to come closer to the road, how come that this population would want him in office for life? How? And all the consequences of all this is that we will have our countries not developing. Instead, there will be just some focus of interminable crises just caused by bad governance and even lack of governance.
Agathon Rwasa is the Deputy Speaker of the Burundian Parliament and leader of the main opposition National Liberation Forces, or FNL. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura. The chairman of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, has urged citizens to disregard results of the presidential election rerun being circulated on social media platforms. Wafula Chibukati says only certified results from the IEBC are credible. It is widely expected that incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta will be declared winner of the election. This after former Prime Minister and main opposition leader Raila Odinga pulled out of the poll, saying it will not be credible. For reaction to last Thursday's repeat presidential election, I reached Jakayo Midiwu, an opposition parliamentarian in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
I think they are more of a sham than the ones for August. Because in the current circumstances, Uhuru Kenyatta was competing only Uhuru Kenyatta. So why are they trying to justify more votes? I mean, whatever he got, he would have won anyway. But I think it shows that we don't have a proper electoral system. It shows that we don't have a proper electoral commission. And I think that Uhuru Kenyatta wants to rule Kenya by brute and through brute force.
Some analysts are saying it was an error for former Prime Minister and the leader of NASA, Raila Odinga, to pull out of the election because Kenyans will be stuck, they said, with the next years or the final years of President Uhuru Kenyatta's presidency, whether the opposition leader likes it or not. What is your reaction to that?
Well, you're going to get stuck. We have to get stuck to move out of the quandary. We don't have a way out. And other than two routes, the two routes that are available to us, we either sit down and talk and say we want to do reform in our country and do it, or we go separate ways in our country. And I think the time is right for us to discuss those two options. Only 3.5 million Kenyans voted, but you do have 20 million Kenyans as registered voters, 19.6 million registered voters. Now, if you look at that, it means majority of Kenyans don't want Uhuru to be their president, and we don't want him to be our president. We think he's there illegally.
Talking about the talks, on what conditions are you going to engage talks with the government, since President Uhuru Kenyatta would have been re-elected, would have the constitutional backing, would be in charge of the levers of government, and I don't think would even give an inch about sharing power for that matter?
Well, we don't want shared power. We want reforms. We don't want to share power. We have tried that part before. It failed. We don't want to share power with Uhuru Kenyatta. He doesn't have the power. What the reality is that 70-something percent of the country don't recognize it. So if he wants to stay in power, we must have two countries. We have to discuss those possibilities. If we want to keep our country together, which we wish and hope, we want to keep it together. But if that is not possible, we must go our separate ways, and hopefully we shall do it peacefully. We are saying we don't want to keep paying taxes to the Central Republic of Kenya. The Central Republic of Kenya, meaning with the tribal cahoots, which are enjoying our taxes and we are getting nothing out of it. I mean, the time is just now. We don't want to do it tomorrow. We want to do it today.
Some have said in government, and supporters of the ruling party have said, the unity of Kenya is non-negotiable. So calling for the separation, some are saying that is even treasonous.
Well, they can call it treasonable and it's not negotiable. If they don't want to negotiate it, they will stay in their own country, we will stay in our own country. We have nothing in common. You know, they are oppressing us, they are killing us. We will have to push them out to protect our people. We will have to protect ourselves. Or we sit down and talk and say, what is in this thing that all of us must enjoy and live peacefully? But you can't sit where bullets kill 8-year-old kids, 5-year-old children. We can't stay in that space. There's not enough space in Kenya for bullets. We did a new constitution. We wanted our police force to become a service. Police are civilians. They cannot kill innocent human beings. And that is what is happening in Kenya. And the international community is mute. Tomorrow we are going to be making announcements. We are going to say whatever we buy that makes the government buy bullets against us, we will stop buying it from tomorrow. This is going to be a long time. It's going to take a longer time if Uhuru Kenyatta doesn't pick up his call and say, this country belongs to all of us. It does not belong to just two tribes. That is the truth. And we are going to show them that. We have decided. You can't, I mean, we'd rather go to our graves. That is the truth.
Jakayo Mediwo is a Kenyan parliamentarian from the main opposition coalition, the National Super Alliance, or NASA. He spoke with me from Nairobi. The chairman of the Sierra Leonean National Electoral Commission says the organization will soon begin the distribution of voter identification cards to be used for the March 7, 2018 general election. Mohamed Konte says the Electoral Commission is also implementing new measures in the run-up to the polls. His remark came after both the ruling All People's Congress, or APC, and the main opposition, the Sierra Leonean People's Party, or SLPP, chose Samora Kamara and former military leader Julius Maada Bio, respectively, as their presidential candidates. For the latest on the preparations ahead of next year's election, I reached Mohamed Konte, chairman of the Electoral Commission in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown.
In preparation for the 7th March 2018 election, we've just completed the voter registration process. The next phase is distribution of voter ID to registered voters. We intend doing that next month, that is November. That's the most important phase for now.
After the voter registration card distribution across the country, what's next?
Well, after the voter card distribution, actually the next phase is to do a village head election, but that is only for the western area, rural district, as the Freetown area is surrounding. But after that, the next major one is actually getting ready for the paramount chief MC elections. Obama Chief Members of Parliament. We intend conducting that one early next year. Then after that, it's really, really the nomination process itself, which is supposed to take place in January. So after that, then the election. These are the major important phases leading to the election itself.
What process will these political parties undergo? Will they have to file official documentation with the Electoral Commission?
Oh, yes. We definitely will have to file documentation. But before that, we definitely will have to look out for the candidates in all the 132 constituencies and over 400 wards. Constituencies for the members of parliament. All the political parties will look out for their own candidates in each constituency, each of the 132 constituencies. And after that, those that will contest the local council elections, they also select their candidates. So for now, the next phase is for them to look at selection of candidates for members of parliament election and council election. Then after that, the filing document for the nomination process.
What has been the voter education process of prospective voters once you distribute the identity card for prospective voters in next year's election?
Well, voter education is really one of our problem areas. But that's actually the next thing we intend starting. To distribute the card, we also will start with voter education. From next month, we will start voter education until next year. But definitely, we will talk with other organizations like IRN, Independent Radio Network, right? A coalition of all radio networks nationwide. We will definitely be working with them.
Will you have the necessary funds to carry out this voter education campaign?
The government has committed, to give us funds. Then we are also getting some assistance from the UNDP and the international community for voter education. But we are working with them.
So what is the Electoral Commission's message to the people of Sierra Leone ahead of the distribution of the identity cards? Now, if they have a problem with the identity cards, what is their next line of action in order to rectify it ahead of the election?
Well, one, through UNDP, through support from the UNDP, we will be printing the voter, printing the register, and putting it in all our districts. But my message to them is that when we give the timetable out, they should go out at their respective centers to collect their cards. If there are problems, they should ensure that they keep their voter ID slips and then bring them to us, then we'll rectify their situation. But we also assure everybody that if you register, then you have your voter ID card or your slip. We'll definitely ensure that you take part in the election process.
Will you have offices across the country where some of these corrections could be made? Because, as you know, some people could be up country and it might be next to impossible for them to come to Freetown to have this rectified.
No, we have offices in all the 14 districts, now 16 districts. We definitely have election offices there, staffed by our permanent staff. We also have ad hoc staff. But we have offices in all the country, the provinces and in the western area.
Mohamed Konte is the chairman of the Sierra Leonean Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from Freetown. Allegations have surfaced again of Qatar's involvement in the movement of Islamic State militants from Iraq and Syria to Libya. For VOA, Edward Uranian looks at the accusations and the Emirates' deteriorating relations with Libya's neighbors, such as Chad, which shut down the Qatari embassy in N'Djamena in August after accusing Qatar of using its soil to destabilize nations in the Lake Chad Basin and the Sahel.
Arab media accused Qatar this week of helping to transport Islamic State militants from Syria and Iraq to the south of Libya, the latest accusations against the Gulf Emirate by a coalition of countries including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. The coalition imposed sanctions against Doha in June for allegedly supporting terrorists. In late August, Chad closed the Qatari embassy in N'Djamena, accusing Qatar of trying to destabilize the country. Chad's Foreign Minister Ibrahim Hussein Taha accused Qatar of supporting opponents of his government. He says that Qatar supports and sponsors Chadian groups opposed to the government both in Libya and in Qatar. Earlier this month, a military spokesman for the Libyan National Army under the command of General Khalifa Haftar told Arab media that Qatar was helping to bring Islamic State terrorists to the south of Libya. The spokesman said Qatari support has not stopped, especially financial support, and accused Doha of committing other crimes against the Libyan people, including transporting Islamic State militants from Syria and Iraq to Sudan and then on to Libya. Former U.S. Defense Secretary and CIA Director Leon Panetta also this week said Qatar has a history of supporting terrorism.
Qatar, frankly, has had a mixed record. We know they've provided support, financial support for the Muslim Brotherhood, for terrorism, for Hamas, for elements of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban.
Christopher Davidson, who teaches Middle East politics at Durham University in Great Britain, argues that Qatar was involved in the transport of weapons and fighters from Libya to Syria in 2012 and 2013. Now he thinks it is involved in the reverse flow as Islamic State falls apart in Syria and Iraq.
Its usefulness has significantly declined in that particular theater of operations. And the weapons and presumably the men, at least the foreign fighters, are being moved to where they're needed most. And I believe one of those locations at the moment is the Libyan conflict.
The shift, he says, is in part a result of a number of regional powers vying for supremacy in Libya, with Qatar on one side and the United Arab Emirates and Egypt on the other. Gulf analyst Theodore Karasik in Washington is more nuanced, saying the accusations against Qatar are a mixed bag.
When you talk to folks in the region about Qatar's activity, it is a mixed view. It is the view that Qatar was involved and has pulled back. And the other one is that Qatar is using Turkey as its partner to continue to be involved in Libya.
Karasik says that many of the accusations are based on rumor, but that it appears Doha continues its support for militants, and that behind the sides, other players such as Sudan and Turkey are involved. Egyptian editor and publisher Hisham Qasim questions whether Qatar is actually physically involved in transporting Islamic State militants to Libya.
It could be true or maybe not. However, I don't think Qatar would be able to transport terrorists from one location to the other and get past all the intelligence services worldwide. And if they were to do that and get caught red-handed, they would be in a very difficult situation now with countries like the States or Europe.
Qasim notes that Qatar has often played the role of go-between for Western states and various terrorist groups such as the Taliban. He points out that many such groups have representatives in Doha.
Qatar has what you call five-star hotel diplomacy. They practically have a representative or more from every political or terrorist or whatever faction in Qatar and are just able to communicate with them to make themselves useful.
He goes on to stress that Qatar is not alone in supporting certain terrorist groups. He believes that other Gulf states have also resorted to terrorism on various occasions in the past as well. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts. Every hour, on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, Al Ahly of Egypt settled for a goalless draw with Morocco's Wydad Casablanca in the first leg of the African Champions League final. Mohamed Zakaria scored after just 3 minutes for Ahly, the record 8-time African champions, at the Borg Al Arab Stadium in Alexandria. But leading Wydad scorer Akraf Benchaki leveled soon after, with dominant Ahly failing to add to their goals tally. The Moroccans now take what could be a precious away goal into the second leg in Casablanca next weekend. They have won all 6 of their Champions League games in Morocco while conceding just 1 goal. Al Ahly seek to extend their record of African Champions League crowns to 9. Whoever wins this year's final will claim a $2.5 million in prize money and represent Africa in December's FIFA Club World Cup final in the United Arab Emirates. In the Confederation Cup, South Africa's Super Sport United reached an African club final for the first time in their history when beating Club Africain 3-1 in Tunisia to win 4-2 on aggregate. The Pretoria-based side will meet defending champions TP Mazembe next month after the Congolese drew 0-0 against FUS Rabat in Morocco to qualify 1-0 on aggregate. SuperSport are only the second South African side to reach the final of African club football's second-tier competition, with the Orlando Pirates beaten there by Tunisians Etoile du Sahel in 2015. 5-time Africa champions Mazembe made it through thanks to Ben Malango's goal in the first leg in Lubumbashi on October 1st. Having won the 2015 Champions League, the Congolese, unbeaten in this year's tournament, are through to a major African club final for the third year in a row. The winner of the Confederation Cup, Africa's football second-tier club competition, will receive $1.25 million in prize money. In boxing, British Anthony Joshua stopped Carlos Takam in 10th round to retain titles. WBA and IBF heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua, with a record of 20 wins with 20 knockouts, scored a 10th round technical knockout over IBF number 3, Carlos Takam, on Saturday night in front of 80,000 at Prince Palliate Stadium in Cardiff, Wales. A second round head clash broke Joshua's nose. Joshua cut Takam over the right eye with a punch in round 4, then dropped him later in the round with a left hook. In the 10th round, the referee suddenly stepped in and waved it off. And in Singapore, Caroline Wozniacki claimed the biggest win of her career when the Dane staved off a ferocious fight back from Venus Williams to take a 6-4-6-4 victory in the WTA Finals title showdown on Sunday. The 37-year-old American, the oldest woman to ever reach the final, had held a 7-0 record over Wozniak going into the match, but the Dane put on an inspired display of serving and retrieving to claim the Elite 8 Women event for the first time after losing a previous final in 2010. Finally, organizers of the New York City Marathon have added Wilson Kipsang and Bhuvnesh Deba to the elite field for the IAAF Gold Label Road Race on November 5th. Kipsang and Deba will now join defending champions Gime Gebrselassie of Eritrea and Mary Kaitani of Kenya, along with leading U.S. runners Meb Kiplezigi and Shellan Flanagan. Kipsang won the New York Marathon in 2014 and went on to claim the World Marathon Majors title that year. Earlier this year, the 35-year-old Kenyan set a course record of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 58 seconds when winning the Tokyo Marathon. At the 2013 Berlin Marathon, Kipsang set a world record which stood as a record for 1 year. The 2012 Olympic bronze medalist has run faster than 2:05 8 times, more than any other runner in history. Deba trains in the Bronx and was the New York City Marathon runner-up in 2011 and 2013. The 30-year-old Ethiopian won the Boston Marathon in 2014, setting a course record of 2:19.59. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Local. Thank you, Lord, oh, everything where I get now your blessing. I wanna see my mama riding Galado someday. I cannot stop. Thank you, Lord, oh, everything where I get now your blessing. I wanna see my mama riding Galado someday. I cannot stop. Mon là, je ne dors pas la nuit. Dehors pour chercher le bruit sain. Ils diront femme là et diront oui, je crois. À genoux devant le Christ. Man, j'avance avec ceux qui veulent bien me suivre. J'ai failli d'être, j'ai pas le temps, il faut que je puisse. Nasi Bental Lambo. Bitch, I want more. Rock and blow. I wanna get on the stage, set the roof on fire. And sing for my pretty girl. I want more. Rock and blow. I wanna get on the stage, set the roof on fire. And sing for my pretty girl. Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Lord. Oh, everything where I get now, I bless you. S'arrêtera là, ils se sont trompés. Une villa pour la maman, telle est la visée.
La visée, la visée.
Un somalo, bah.
Dis-moi.
Tell them they need to know. Oh, oh. I get this feeling in my heart. Oh. I put this feeling on the beat and my people go crazy. I get this feeling in my heart. Oh. I get this feeling that my dreams can come true. Yeah, yeah. I get this feeling in my heart. Oh. On the beat and my people go crazy. I get this feeling in my heart, oh. I get this feeling that my dream can come true. Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Lord, oh, everything where I get now a blessing. I wanna see my mama riding Galado someday. I cannot stop. Thank you, Lord, oh, everything where I get now a blessing. I wanna see my mama riding Galado someday. I cannot stop.
Don't play with us, Lord. Don't play.
Tattoo.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Separatist groups in Africa as well as in other parts of the world should learn clear lessons from what is now transpiring in Catalonia in Spain. It tells the story of the folly and risk of declaring independence within a recognized sovereign state. Catalonia is one of the regions of Spain. It has full autonomy with its own parliament, police force. But it also happens to be the richest region in Spain, and the Catalans resent the fact that their taxes were being used to assist the poor, other poor regions of Spain. So even though they were aware that the constitution does not allow for independence, they decided to hold a referendum, and that referendum authorized independence. And on last Friday, the regional government declared independence, and immediately the central government in Madrid took action under Article 155 of the Constitution. And on Saturday morning, the government of Spain took over the autonomous government of Catalonia, and the leaders were dismissed, and many of them are being charged with sedition. No one knows how this is going to end. But from history, one must take into account that the Second World War was preceded with the Spanish Civil War of 1936-39, and it was used as a trial ground for many of the European powers to test their weapon system. Now, separatist groups and those in Catalonia are always talking about invoking the right of self-determination. But self-determination cannot be invoked in any absolute manner. In fact, the concept of self-determination was introduced into an international legal agreement at the end of the First World War by the then U.S. President Woodrow Wilson, who before he became president was a professor at Princeton University and was concerned by the turmoil in the Balkan regions that led to the First World War. But he himself regretted the fact that the term was being misused and felt if he had known that, he would not have introduced the term. Nevertheless, the term served as a facilitator for many independent states in Africa, in Asia, and in the Caribbean, because these were all inscribed in the new United Nations Charter in 1945. The term itself enabled the people of South Africa to exercise their right of self-determination in 1994. So for the people of Namibia. But when you have a sovereign state, the question comes, who determines self-determination? It is possible that one can exercise that right if the sovereign state allows it. Recently, the government of the United Kingdom allowed the people of Scotland to vote on the right of self-determination, and of course the majority wanted to stay in the United Kingdom. In Eritrea, Ethiopia allowed a referendum conducted by the United Nations, so Eritrea won and it is now an independent state. In the Sudan, the comprehensive agreement allowed the people of South Sudan to exercise the right of self-determination, and they became independent. So when you have the sovereign government agreeing to exercise the right of self-determination, it could be done. But it could not be done unilaterally, as we found out by Ian Smith in then South Rhodesia, which was then an illegal right of self-determination. We know that China is not allowing Tibet to exercise its right of self-determination. Similarly, call in Hong Kong for independence is not being allowed by China. So the issue of self-determination is not absolute, and separatist groups must be wary of exercising that right. So keep watching what is happening in Spain, Catalonia, because it is a useful lesson also to African states. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, rice needs lots of water when cooking, but cannot be cooked on top of the sea. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has supported Burma's gradual transition toward an open democratic society in recent years, but at the same time, we express our gravest concern with recent events in Rakhine State and the violent, dramatic abuses Rohingya and other communities have endured, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. It is imperative, she said, that any individuals or entities responsible for atrocities, including non-state actors and vigilantes, be held accountable. That's why the United States is taking the following actions. Since August 25th, the United States has ceased consideration of JADE Act travel waivers for current and former senior leadership of the Burmese military. The U.S. is considering economic options available to target individuals associated with atrocities. All units and officers involved in operations in northern Rakhine State are considered to be ineligible to receive or participate in any U.S. assistance programs. The U.S. has rescinded invitations for senior Burmese security forces to attend U.S.-sponsored events. The U.S. is working with international partners to gain access to relevant areas for the United Nations fact-finding mission, international humanitarian organizations, and media. The U.S. is consulting with allies and partners on accountability options at the U.N., the U.N. Human Rights Council, and other appropriate venues. And the U.S. is also exploring targeted sanctions. The United States will continue to support Burma's transition to democracy, as well as efforts to resolve the current crisis in Rakhine State, which has caused more than 600,000 Rohingya to flee since August 25th. The government of Burma, including its armed forces, must take immediate action to ensure peace and security, implement commitments to ensure humanitarian access to communities in desperate need, facilitate the safe and voluntary return of those who have fled or been displaced in Rakhine State, and address the root causes of systematic discrimination against the Rohingya by implementing the Rakhine Advisory Commission's recommendations, which includes providing a credible path to citizenship. The United States stands ready to support these efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.